Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Most Americans are familiar with the Lincoln Memorial. Indeed, it's one of the nation's most popular tourist attractions. But why? Why is it so important to us? What does this monument to the slain leader mean to us? And has that meaning changed over the years? In a few minutes, we'll pose these and other questions about the Lincoln Memorial to our guest, Christopher Thomas. But first, Joey Skidmore takes a look at an important event that occurred this week in history.
This week in history, on February 21, 1965, Malcolm X was assassinated by three gunmen on the stage at Manhattan's Audubon Ballroom. Malcolm was one of eight children born to Louise and Earl Little on May 19, 1925, in Omaha, Nebraska. His father was a Baptist minister and supporter of black nationalist leader Marcus Garvey, and the family was forced to move twice because of death threats by white supremacists. In 1929, their home in Lansing, Michigan, was destroyed by fire, and in 1931, when Malcolm was 6 years old, his father was brutally murdered. His mother was committed to a mental institution, and the children were split up and placed in foster care. Malcolm dropped out of high school and became involved in Harlem's drug, gambling, and prostitution rings. He was arrested and jailed, but while in prison, he joined the Muslim religious organization, the Nation of Islam. Its leader, Elijah Muhammad, taught that white society prevented African Americans from empowerment or achieving parity in political, economic, and social terms, and he advocated a separate state for African Americans. Malcolm changed his name from Little, considering that to be a slave name, to X to show his lost African identity. Upon his release from prison in 1952, Malcolm X became a minister of the Nation of Islam, but he was soon caught up in the tensions within the organization. And his philosophy became more extreme. His comment that JFK's assassination was a matter of the, quote, chickens coming home to roost, led to his suspension from the church. He founded the Muslim Mosque Incorporated, and later, after his return from a pilgrimage to Mecca, the Organization of Afro-Americans. Death threats ensued, however, and in February 1965, his home, where he lived with his wife and four daughters, was firebombed. 1 week later, Malcolm X was murdered.
Turning to items of historical interest in the news, most Civil War buffs will tell you that Robert E. Lee was a military genius and Ulysses S. Grant a butcher who used the North's advantage in men and material to bludgeon the Confederates into submission. Not so, says Gordon Rhea, the author of Cold Harbor, Grant and Lee, May 26 to June 3, 1864, which is the fourth in a projected five-volume series of books he's writing on the Overland Campaign. There's been a shift in Grant's reputation in the past few years, Rhea writes. I think he's been painted into a corner of being a butcher when in fact he was extremely thoughtful, very innovative, and every bit Lee's match. The Overland Campaign was a string of battles lasting 46 days that preceded Grant's 10-month siege of Petersburg, Virginia, and much of Grant's reputation as a butcher stems from that campaign. The traditional picture is that Grant was a man who always made head-on attacks and didn't care how many men he lost, Rhea explains. He was actually a master of maneuver. He never made attacks unless he felt he had a reasonable chance of succeeding. So why did history treat Lee so kindly and Grant so badly? Because Lee had better press, Rhea notes. Grant was considered a hero during the war, but his reputation faded thereafter. Lee's rose. This is Talking History. The Lincoln Memorial is one of the most popular sites in the nation's capital. People go there to contemplate the fallen leader, to rally around civil rights issues with which they associate Abraham Lincoln, or just to marvel at the monument's design. Christopher Thomas has written a book on the Lincoln Memorial, and he is Jim Madison's guest this week on Talking History.
Few visitors to Washington, D.C. miss the Lincoln Memorial. Few can imagine the Capitol without this American icon. And yet we don't think much about how it was created or about its many meanings, its ambiguous and changing meanings. Our guest today helps us approach this memorial in a larger and deeper context. He's Christopher A. Thomas, a professor at the University of Victoria in British Columbia, and the author of a new book published by Princeton University Press entitled The Lincoln Memorial, An American Life. Welcome, Professor Thomas.
Thank you.
Let's think about this memorial in what we see and what we feel. One of the nice things about your book, I thought, is how you bring it to life. Can you describe it for us, if only briefly, the features
sure.
of the book, of the memorial?
Sure. Some people think of the Lincoln Memorial as only the seated statue of Lincoln, but in fact it's a building, and the building is more than a frame for the statue. It's important in its own right. It's a modified Greek temple with its a door in its side wall, which faces the mall, and then a horizontal Roman attic, rather than a typical pediment. It appears to rest on a mound, but in fact it's a kind of underground skyscraper, because that's landfill down there on the mall, and it's the terminal feature of the mall, about a mile beyond the Washington Monument.
Well, those are good starts on helping us visualize it and remember what most of us have seen. But what gives its appeal for us? What about its architecture, its construction, its placement gives it such iconographic appeal?
Well, that axial vista of the memorial from a mile or even 2 miles distance from the Capitol is part of its power. It can be seen from the terrace of the Capitol. And with its very wide open entrance and visibility of the statue at the top of the steps, it's extremely powerful. And then it seems to invite visitors in, and then they're very captured by the statue itself, by Daniel Chester French, which is both powerful in being imposing, but also very personal. It's a very affectionate Lincoln there, I think. And then as they turn from the statue to the side chambers, they start to read the addresses on the side walls. And I think that reminds us that Lincoln was very much a president of the word.
Yes.
Spoken word.
As much as so many of us like the Lincoln Memorial today, not everyone liked it at the time, did they?
No, they didn't. Believe it or not, the Lincoln Memorial was actually quite a controversial object. In fact, various factions, particularly in the Republican Party, had been trying to commemorate Lincoln in the Capitol since the end of the Civil War, since his assassination. But he was a difficult man to commemorate because the nation's attention was on reuniting the country, and Lincoln was a somewhat divisive figure with whites in the South. Finally, then, a sort of vision for a memorial to Lincoln was presented in the form of the McMillan Plan of 1901 to 1902 for the aggrandizement of the mall, terminating in a great memorial to Lincoln. But then it had to be a memorial to him as Union saver rather than as emancipator, as far as the white audience was concerned.
So let me just underline that point, if I may, Chris. The major point made by this memorial when it was built is what?
That Lincoln is the savior of the Union. If the Capitol at the far end of the mall is the symbol of the American government and the Constitution, and the obelisk of the Washington Monument is a symbol of the founder of the nation, then the memorial to Lincoln is to him as Union saver. And standing there at the reunion point of the bridge from Virginia, it's a powerful symbolic placement, and that the theme of union and reunion is stressed throughout the memorial, really, including in the dedicatory inscription.
Right.
In this temple, as in the hearts of the people for whom he saved the Union, the memory of Abraham Lincoln is enshrined.
So now, what's missing there?
Almost any reference to race.
Right.
And to the act of racial bad faith that the end of Reconstruction was. That, you know, issues that were not really resolved until the 1950s and the 1960s.
There is, however, on one of the sides, the mural of emancipation, correct?
Yes.
Is that a serious statement?
Well, yes, it's a serious statement, but it's rather abstract. That the title of that mural, and many visitors hardly realize that there are murals above the address tablets. In fact, it's significant that I didn't mention them when I was first describing the memorial.
Right.
Very, very abstract and rather remote. One of the murals is called The Emancipation of a Race. And it's a very indirect reference to emancipation. Of course, there is a reference to race and to slavery as being the ultimate cause of the Civil War in Lincoln's second inaugural, but it too is a rather veiled reference, and it's clear that the emphasis in the memorial is on him as Union savior.
Right. So this focus on Lincoln as savior of the Union, this de-emphasization of race and emancipation comes out of a compromise implicit in the early 20th century?
Yes, really a compromise reached by the Republican Party with white Southerners at the end of Reconstruction. You know, we'll withdraw our troops and we won't make you uncomfortable with the reality of Jim Crow.
Right, right.
And this was a continuing attitude of the Republican Party into the 20th century.
One of the very interesting details in this book, as I read it, Chris, was your indication that at the dedication ceremony for the Lincoln Memorial, and this is in 1922, is that correct?
Correct, yes.
That there was in the seating section, a segregated area for African Americans attending.
That's right. That's right. That was the irony. The all public events, monument dedications and so forth, that took place in the district park system were organized by the Army Corps of Engineers, which was generally headed by Southern white officers. And so they simply assumed that any large event taking place in Potomac Park in 1922 would be segregated. There appears to have been one Marine usher in particular who was a little abusive of some of the people. But the
some of the African Americans attending the ceremony?
Apparently, yeah. yes. And this was picked up in the black press, the Chicago Defender especially. And, of course, ironically enough, on the platform there was an address given by an African American speaker discussing Lincoln's meaning for African Americans. But even he was handpicked to be as mild-mannered and inoffensive as possible.
Okay, so we have a situation here, the Lincoln Memorial created in the early 20th century, focusing on really ignoring central issues of race, of emancipation. And then we have a situation a half century later that culminates with Martin Luther King standing in front of that very memorial in 1963.
Correct.
How do we get there? How do we get to that point? How does this memorial change in its meaning?
Yeah, it very much did change in its meaning. It changed very much to consider the question of race, and in a way it reversed its signification from being a Republican monument to being a Democratic monument. And that happened particularly in the New Deal years. But actually immediately after the dedication, in the reviews of the dedication in the African American press, there was a sort of promise to rededicate the memorial in such a way as to become a site representing justice. And the opportunity for that essentially was in Marian Anderson's concert on Easter 1939 when Anderson, the well-known black American contralto, was refused the use of any other auditoria in Washington on the basis of her race, because Washington then was essentially segregated. And the New Deal administration, especially the Secretary of the Interior, made the Lincoln Memorial available for an Easter Day concert in 1939, which was broadcast widely and reported in the press around the world. And from then on through the 1940s and the 1950s, the memorial was used repeatedly by the NAACP and other organizations. Climaxing in the Great March on Washington in August 1963.
Is that usage simply because there's no other place available, or is that usage for other reasons? Is it deliberate? Is it planned? Does it have a purpose in selecting?
It was very deliberate, yes. It was a very deliberate act of appropriation of the memorial and of the memory of Lincoln as emancipator.
Right.
It was a reappropriation by African Americans,
and in doing that, they're changing the meaning from the man who saved the Union.
Correct.
Yes.
Correct. Until now, we actually think of the memorial as a place of popular, at least partly, as a place of popular dissent, as a place of democratic protest, And that meaning was cemented, I would say, during the Vietnam War, when the memorial was often a rallying point or a staging point for anti-war protest, which is one of the reasons, not the only reason, but one of the reasons why the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, the powerful Vietnam Veterans Memorial, is placed almost in its shadow, opened in 1982.
Can you explain that connection a little bit more? What is the relationship there of placement in the shadow? What do you mean in the shadow? Physically?
Almost literally, yes. As you're aware, when Maya Ying Lin designed the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, she made it as a sort of as a long but shallow V with two arms, one of which points to the Washington Monument, the other to the Lincoln Memorial, in an act of homage to the older memorials, but I think also a kind of act of accusation. You know, see how our ideals, see how the war has betrayed our ideals, or at least questioned our ideals.
Yes.
Put it that way. And particularly because the Vietnam Veterans Memorial is so close, physically so close to the Lincoln Memorial, it shares restrooms. It shares a souvenir shop, for instance. It seems to exist in very close proximity to the Lincoln Memorial.
Do you suspect that most visitors to Washington, when they go to the Vietnam Wall, when they go to the Lincoln Memorial, do they think about things the way you're talking about them now?
I think some do. I think some, if they turn back as they walk, first of all, many of them would disembark from their tour buses around the Lincoln Memorial, and they perhaps look first at the figural statuary near the entrance to the VVM, and they then start to walk down that path toward the apex of the Vietnam Memorial. If they think to look back, they will certainly notice that the wall points directly to the Lincoln Memorial.
Yes.
Some visitors would be conscious of it. On the other hand, one of the reasons for this book, of course, is to draw visitors' attention to that.
Exactly, yes. You note in your introduction, so I'm not spilling a secret here, but you note in your introduction that you are a Canadian citizen.
That's right.
Does this, you think, affect your understanding of the Lincoln Memorial or even of America?
I think it does. Oh, yes, I think it's significant. Canadians are, on the one hand, foreign. I mean, we're a sovereign state, but on the other hand, not very foreign, you know, and that's one reason why we're often ignored, I think. It's not just an act of insult. It's often just an, oh, Canada, oh, that's right, Canada is independent. So there's a sort of friendliness to it, too. Well, for one thing, unlike an American school child, I didn't actually see Washington until I was doing my doctorate, until 1985. So I didn't physically go to the Lincoln Memorial until I was in my 30s. By which time I could see that it was a very, very powerful site.
But when you went there that first time, did you get the kind of lump in your throat that many Americans do? Really?
I did. Yes, I did. Canadians are, you know, because of our engagement in American popular culture, we can oddly enough be quite patriotic.
You can have it both ways, can't you?
I think, yeah. On the other hand, there's a kind of reflexive skepticism, a kind of critical questioning of things American and American patriotism, which, as I say, I think is reflexive to most Canadians. It puts us in the position of being like sort of marginalized Americans, perhaps racial minorities. We always kind of have that jerk backwards at patriotic rhetoric. And so I think it makes us easier, I think it makes it easier for us to question American verities.
Well, thank you very much. You've helped us, Americans and Canadians, to understand America and certainly the Lincoln Memorial. Our guest today on Talking History has been Christopher A. Thomas, author of The Lincoln Memorial and American Life. Thank you very much, Chris.
Most welcome.
Dying of a heart attack while shining, Mr. Lincoln. the money, and then there's them that ain't.
Site of the week, we call to your attention a new online collection of documents on the Civil War. Here to tell you about it is Talking History's Fiona Beattie.
A vast, virtually unexamined National Archives collection on Missouri Civil War history is now accessible online at the Missouri State Archives website. The voluminous collection includes legal documents, narratives, and correspondence that tell the story of ordinary Missourians during the most extraordinary time in their history. The source is the National Archives collection of papers belonging to the Provost Marshals, whom the Union Army installed in countless Missouri communities to mete out rough-and-ready justice as Civil War justice broke down and martial law took over. The collection, which sat virtually unused in the National Archives in Washington, is packed with anecdotal details of runaway slaves, house burnings, Confederate property destroyed or taken, demands for Union loyalty, and requests for help. You can find the Union Provost Marshal's papers at the Missouri State Archives website. Keyword, Provost.
And finally, we look at presidential power. For our commentary of the week, Talking History regular Alan Winkler considers how various modern American presidents have exercised the power of their office to lead the nation. Winkler is Distinguished Professor of History at Miami University of Ohio.
George Bush's Republican Party made significant gains in the recent midterm election and now controls the White House and both houses of Congress. With a sympathetic legislative branch, Bush seeks to exercise presidential power in implementing his agenda. But how much does a pronouncement of intent make him a political leader? Political scientists and historians have studied the presidency in great detail in trying to understand how the office works. About 40 years ago, I first read Richard Neustadt's brief book, Presidential Power, The Politics of Leadership, that President John F. Kennedy was said to have kept on his bedside table. It examined the subtle and not-so-subtle ways a chief executive could achieve desired ends, and its lessons remain instructive today. Franklin Roosevelt was a master of the media. He could joke and banter with the press, and that easy manner ensured sympathetic coverage. He knew how to use humor to deflect criticism, and he had a superb radio voice that made people listening to his fireside chats believe that he was talking directly to them. Perhaps even more important, he was willing to take bold action to address the ravages of the Great Depression. For the first time, staff members wrote bills for presentation in Congress and worked for their approval. The 15 major measures passed during the first 100 days are a testament to the success of leadership. Dwight Eisenhower, in Neustadt's view, had a much more limited view of how to make the presidency work. Ike argued, was unwilling to twist arms to punish those who voted against the party line, and his administration suffered as a result. More recently, other scholars have challenged that view, declaring that Eisenhower in fact operated a kind of hidden-hand presidency, quietly asserting his power in his own way. Ike himself on one occasion declared, "Now look, I happen to know a little something about leadership," and went on to talk about persuasion and conciliation and the other tools he used. John Kennedy, however many times he read Neustadt's book, was a less than successful president, at least in the legislative arena. He had razor-thin Democratic majorities in Congress, to be sure, but he was unable or unwilling to force action in the arena, and his leadership, charismatic reputation notwithstanding, was disappointing. Ronald Reagan mastered the media in much the same way as FDR. His television addresses, whether one agreed or disagreed with his position, were powerful. I sometimes found myself shaking my head after watching one of them, impressed with the presentation of a skillful actor at work, forcing myself to realize that I opposed everything he had said. Reagan also had a vision of a mythic America and used his presidential muscle to move the country in that direction. Never mind that the America he imagined never existed. His ideas shaped the parameters of American policy and changed the terms of national debate. Now the question remains, how effective a leader is George Bush? A somewhat dubious president who won by a whisker in the contested election of 2000, he put his own prestige on the line in seeking a sympathetic Congress, and it evidently made a difference. But this was hardly a mandate, and the nation remains as divided as it was before. Though Bush's speeches are getting better, some of them remain embarrassing. With a stock set of talking points, he can be a successful stump speaker, but when it comes to a more formal address, his rhetoric continues to sound strident and shrill. Alas, he seems to be getting his way in both the UN and in Congress. Unlikely as it appears, he may be a leader to be contended with yet.
You've been listening to Alan Winkler, Distinguished Professor of History at Miami University of Ohio. And that's it for another week of Talking History. We hope you've enjoyed the show. We invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Joey Skidmore, producer. Fiona Beatty, assistant producer. You can learn more about Talking History and the OAH at oah.org. Until next time, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.